This holiday, BMW has reunited three members of the family at the BMW Road Home Sales Event. The Agile X3, engineered for any adventure. The plug-in hybrid X5, commanding the streets with unmatched presence. And the all-electric i4, charging into the future with impeccable performance. Hurry in to find what powers your journey at the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through January 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
I'm Anna Garcia with True Crime News, the podcast. Every crime tells a story. Every story demands justice. True Crime News, the podcast, covers breaking crimes, investigating high-profile and under-the-radar cases. Every week, we dive beyond the headlines, exploring the effects of violent crimes on victims and search for justice. We hope you join us as your weekly source for true crime news. Listen to and follow True Crime News, the podcast, on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Is there any joins me now? Chris, what are we listening to?
That is Zero by the Yeah Yeah Yeahs in honor of Draymond Green's 0 points and Draymond Green's 0 assists and Draymond Green's 0 rebounds and Steph Curry's 0 field goals.
That's a lot of zeros. Chris Harrington has written a piece over at the Daily Memphian, and I would urge you to read it, about last night's festivities at FedEx Forum, in which you wrote that Draymond Green just played the worst game of all time.
I think it may have been the worst game of basketball ever played by a person in the world. Yeah.
What's the evidence? What's the evidence that it is the worst game ever played in the world, in the history of the world?
So no one is, so the individual futility is the 0-0-0 in real time, 19 minutes of play, 0-0-0. He has never personally had a triple zero in as many minutes, him personally. Mm-hmm. The negative 42 is pretty bad. It's not the worst ever. There are, I think, I remember like 80-something, 82 players in NBA history have been worse than negative 42 in the plus-minus. But no one has ever paired the triple zero with a negative 42 before. The previous record for worst plus minus for a triple zero game was Walter McCarty for the Boston Celtics in 2002, was negative 40 with a triple zero.
A triple zero and the worst. Yes, that's absolutely. It's pretty clear the worst game of all time. Plus, I don't know who pointed out, someone on Twitter, there were wonderful stats flying all over the place. It is the worst by a player who has played fewer than 20 minutes. So he was also bad very efficiently as well. He was hideous very efficiently as well. Obviously, much was made, maybe too much was made of Draymond and the comments and all of that. But it did feel like, and the Grizzlies downplayed it afterwards, but it did feel like they were irked by his comments. Don't you believe?
Sure they were. They used that for motivation. The thing about getting riled up or whatever about Draymond Green comments, Draymond Green is desperate for attention, and so you're giving him what he wants because he just wants attention all the time. He can't stop himself. And I mean, the joke I make in the column is that at this point, you would think that Draymond Green talking would sound like the parents in a Peanuts cartoon. It would just be like you wouldn't really hear it anymore. Right. Because he just never stops. He's always talking. You see someone talking right now.
You posit that the Ja Morant block, he has had greater blocks, but maybe no block more satisfying. In fact, that sequence from beginning to end, pretty spectacular from the Grizzlies' perspective.
That's the sequence of the season. Usually it's like some fast break, some like, you know, block that leads to a fast break with an alley-oop. That's usually my sequence of the season. Uh-huh. But that might be my sequence of the season. Blocking Draymond Green, and then Draymond Green being so mad about it, he looks for someone to bully, and he finds Zach Edey, and that does not work out for him. And so, like, that may be my sequence of the season.
I like the word you chose. Zach Edey almost seemed bemused by Draymond Green.
I thought that was the look. It showed, that's not on like the clip I could find, but watching the game live, at one point they showed like the close-up.
Yeah.
And it looked like Zach Edey was just sort of smirking at Draymond Green, like, whatever, dude. And Santiago Dallas was literally just standing there laughing in his face.
Oh, it was a beautiful thing. Okay, so what does it mean, Chris? What does it mean? Does this games like this have any significance?
But yeah, I mean, but, it's one game. I'm not that big on what is the meaning of this game. But I do think the Grizzlies, if you put this in the context of the season, I think what you see is that this, the way the Grizzlies play, like, again, I'm not saying they're the best team in the league. They're not. I'm not saying they're most likely to come out of the West. There's real questions about once you get into the sort of crucible of playoff basketball or whatever. But over the course of the regular season, the way they play, the way they apply their depth to their pace and their style and the chemistry they bring to it, it's a machine that hums. And when it really gets humming, it can just rack up big scores. And even when they're off, like, they still sort of stick around. Like, they blow out teams a lot, they don't get blown out, you know? And I pointed to, I sort of started a column by looking at the last two Grizzlies games where the Grizzlies go to Los Angeles and they just don't have it. The whole team is a mess from the tip. And, like, they lose by six at the end. And then you come to this game and the Warriors don't have it. The whole team's a mess from the tip. And they lose by 51. And there's something about this Grizzlies team. Like, not only do they have, not only was that the biggest win from a point differential standpoint in the NBA this season, they broke their own. They already had it. It was by 45 at Portland. Now they have the two biggest. And they just have a lot of big wins and not a lot of big losses. And I think partly that's the style of play and, like, how good they are with that style.
Obviously, a little damper on it when Ja went down. He was laughing and smiling at the end. And so, you know, I don't know. Like, it is interesting, as you pointed out. It's not so much even the dunking. It's the high. It's careening into the lane 6 feet in the air or whatever it is. And that's where we saw the injury, you know?
Yeah, and it looked like, it's unclear whether, right, someone asked me on Blue Sky about, you know, what was it? Was it the hip or was it the back? And, like, these things are sort of connected to each other, you know. And so, like, he got bumped on the hip in the air, and then he landed on the back. And it looked to me like the bump may have been a bigger thing than the landing, but they're kind of the same thing,
right?
I mean, if he had already had the hip injury, I think it would be less concerning. But it seems like something that would re-aggravate, or at least from a soreness standpoint, if nothing else, right? It would be relevant. And so I don't know. I mean, the fact that he was questionable and, like, you know, he was apparently going to shoot the free throws if they had lost the challenge, if they hadn't lost the challenge, you know, I doubt it's some major thing, but it's not going to shock me if he misses some time.
Right.
At least 2 days from now, he's not playing the way he looked.
And it gets to your central truth about this team from the beginning of the season, which is if Ja, Jaren, and Dez are healthy, they're good. They're very good.
Yeah.
But there's real
durability. There is over the last few seasons, and Jaren has gone the other way.
Isn't it weird? Like, Jaren was the one who was the question for the longest time.
Right.
And now he's always there, it appears. Knock on whatever.
No, it's Morant and Bane. Like, the durability questions and concerns have really built with those guys over the last two or three seasons.
All right. So then the other interesting thing that happened was Zach Edey was elevated back into the starting lineup. What did you make of that?
Drew and I talked about this on the pod a few days ago about whether that should happen, and I was sort of agnostic about it. I was fine I was fine either way on that one. I don't think it's a big deal. I think he needs to play a lot. I think you watched that game, like, he was good because everybody was good, but there was one specific manner in which he was not good at all, and that was when he got the ball in the paint, he would bring the ball down a little bit, and they would just swarm on him, and I think he had four turnovers that way. It was kind of a mess. He's just got to get better at that. He's got to get better at keeping the ball high. He's got to get better at being stronger with the ball and anticipating that better. He just needs more time. He hasn't actually played that much. I think the question of starting him, I wrote a little bit about this as a secondary item today. I just sort of did a little grid where I showed the results so far of all the different front court combinations. And one thing that jumps out of that is something I think I've talked about on this show before, where everyone says, you know, Jaren and Brandon works great. Which is true, but Jaren and Zach Edey have actually been better this season, numbers-wise. But I don't think that's the main thing. I think the main thing is flip it the other way, and you look at what works without Jaren. And Zach Edey and Jaren have worked really well, but they won't play Zach Edey with Brandon Clark or Jay Huff. They basically haven't done that. And so the Zach Edey-Santi Aldama stuff has been good on offense but bad on defense. So it works out to a net positive, but only like a small one. Which sort of makes sense when you think about that combination. It'd be good on offense and bad on defense. And so there's this question of, like, what do you do with Zach Edey when Jaren's not on the floor? I think that's a little bit of a problem for the team. Well, that becomes less of a problem when you play him with Jaren more. If he starts with Jaren, then you minimize the amount of minutes over the course of the game, you're trying to play Zach Edey without Jaron.
So
and Brandon Clark is good with Santi Aldama and good with Jay Huff and good with whatever. You know?
In non-Jaron minutes, what's been the best front court combination?
Oh, I don't have all that in front of me, but like, a lot of it's been good. Santi Aldama and Brandon Clark has been good. That's probably been the best one without Jaron, not surprisingly. The Santi Jay Huff stuff has been really good. The Huff Clark has been great, but it's just too small of a sample. I don't really put a lot of stock in that. But their best combinations without Jaron have been Santi Brandon and Santi Huff.
But that's interesting. So if you play Edey with Jaron and start him, what that does, because as you phrased it, it's not that Edey and Jaron are better than Brandon and Jaron. It's that Edey needs Jaron more. And so by starting him, you get him with the Jaron minutes.
Yeah, and you can still close games with Jaron and Brandon or Jaron and Santi and just see how the game flows, right? I think the game flow over 48 minutes is probably going to be better that way.
Fascinating. And so you think they did this and will continue to do this going forward? Do you think this was a move?
I don't know. They've made noises about being situational with that. They haven't embraced that, but they sort of made noises about it. And it makes sense. Brandon Clark and Zach Edey are so different from each other that you would sort of adjust the matchups on that. That is something I used to advocate back in the day with Tony Allen. Like, start him in the games where you need that defense more. And, you know, and like, I even had like Jason Levine and I actually talked about this once. And Jason Levine would say, I agree with you, but coaches won't really go for this. And players want to know what their role is, et cetera, et cetera. So, like, I don't know whether they'll do that and actually really just game-to-game decision with it. But, like, it wouldn't be a crazy thing to do.
Also in the column, people can read it at the Daily Memphian. Chris has written about last night's festivities and then and some thoughts about other matters. One is Santi Aldama was terrific last night, and it had begun to occur to you he could be a Sixth Man of the Year candidate.
Well, somebody asked me about that a few weeks ago, he wasn't really like on my list, my middle list or whatever of players who for that, but that has jumped out to me. And that's because he had started so many games. I think at one point this season, he had started like more than half the games he had played when that question first started popping up. And if you start more than half your games, you can't be Sixth Man of the Year. Well, now he's settled into the bench role and he really is playing as the Sixth Man. And in that role, he probably hasn't been the best player in the league in that role. That's probably been Peyton Pritchard, who may just run away with that. But Santi, I think, legitimately has been among the better players in the league in that role.
And then in terms of the Warriors' perspective, obviously it's one game, you flush it, right, as they say.
But they're 4-12, I think,
exactly.
In the last 16, something
That's
like that.
It's one game, but it's not – it is a – what do you make of what's happened with the Warriors?
I think they were over their heads early this season, and I think I should have recognized that instead of like being, oh, well, the Warriors are doing it again.
Right.
I think the truth of that roster, even though they got off to a good start, what that roster looked like before the season is still what that roster looks like. And that's, they've got one all-NBA guy and no one else who's even remotely close to that, even remotely. Like, you know, no one else who's even remotely an all-star anymore. And that's just, it's hard to win big with that kind of roster, as great as Steph Curry is. And so, they got Steph Curry, and they have depth, and they're well coached, and blah blah blah. But like, the roster's just not that good, and I think that's sort of, I think they'll turn it around and be better than, like, you know, they won't play at a 4-12 rate the rest of the way. But I don't think they're going to suddenly become a 10-2 rate team either, you know.
So if you are a which fan base is more distraught today, or more irritated or disturbed by the results of last night, the Golden State fan base, or the Minnesota fan base, which loses, they lose 133-107 in the Cat return game, and he goes for 32-20.
Yeah, I don't listen to Minnesota sports talk radio. I'm strictly a Memphis guy as far as that goes, so I don't know what they're talking about here this morning.
Uh-huh.
But it was funny, last night on social media, Chris Hine, who's the beat writer for the Star Tribune, the last thing I saw him tweet, or I don't know whether it was Twitter or Blue Sky or whatever, but the last thing I saw him post was like telling all of his followers to just turn off Twitter and go to bed. everyone calm down. So I think there's a lot of, for one thing, that game happened at home for them,
right,
not on the road. And, like, yeah, Grizzlies-Warriors is a rivalry game that people anticipate, but that was Cat's first time back in Minnesota in a Knicks uniform. They made that trade. This is a team that was in the Western Conference Finals last year. They made that trade. They've been far worse this year. And then they just get absolutely smoked in their gym with him going off. That was a rough scene.
That is a rough scene. Do we think we can now say it was a mistake?
Yeah, but the main driver of it was money.
Yeah.
There was a reason to think that it would work basketball wise, but the fundamental truth was always, if it weren't for the tax reasons, it would not have happened. And so it happened for the tax reasons. And it was, I think they say that saw an opportunity not to get better, but to stay as good while cleaning up their books. And they cleaned up their books, but they did not stay as good.
It was the Rudy Gay. I mean, it was bigger in some ways, but it was what the Grizzlies did, what they did with Rudy Gay, and I think actually did make them better. But the driver was, we have to get rid of Rudy Gay's salary. And here's a way to justify it. Here we can bring in Tayshaun Prince, and we can do this, and we'll be just as good.
Yeah, I think the Rudy thing was sort of it was more equally balanced in terms of the money reasons and the basketball reasons.
Right.
Like, they really believed in the basketball reasons. I can tell you that. The decision makers did, at least. The coach did not necessarily. Lionel didn't, but like the front office people did. This case was not that. I don't think they looked at. I think it was driven almost entirely by the luxury tax, and it was like, oh, this might work for us on the court too, but we got to take the opportunity to do this.
All right, Chris. Well, we're on next Monday, but after that, we are no longer. We're taking a break for the holidays. So we talked earlier about you having seen a complete unknown, and you were going to tell us at some later date what you thought. Is today that day?
That's up to you. It's a Jeff Hawkins
show. What do you think? How was it?
I really like a complete unknown. I'm going to have my year-end movie list. I've already written it. I think this weekend they're going to publish it. And there are a bunch of movies opening on Christmas Day, but that's the one, maybe the only one, that it will be on my top 10 is a complete unknown. And this is the one movie where I sort of had to separate, like, how good I think it is from how much I enjoyed it. Because, like, I know and care an awful lot about the subject here.
Right.
Which could lead me to, like, be more picky about it. In this case, it doesn't. I think it's really good. I could be here all day, which you don't have time for. It's interesting to me. You can tell from the trailers the movie was going to do two things. It was going to be about Bob Dylan, the artist, the kid who shows up in New York, stands in the middle of this folk scene and sort of blows it up and then leaves. And it was going to be sort of this, like, romantic triangle, him and Joan Baez and the other girlfriend character whose name they changed. And I thought it was going to lean more into the romantic stuff because that is more generalized and thus, you know, easier for filmgoers who are not necessarily big Bob Dylan fans, you know? And it doesn't really do that. It focuses more on the music and on the art. And one of the things that it does that I think is great is that it doesn't try to explain the art and where it came from. It's not one of these, his childhood trauma explains his art or where he came from. The whole point of it, and which at one point is close to articulated, which is core to like the Bob Dylan ethos, is that he invented it all. Bob Dylan doesn't even exist. Bob Dylan is the fictional creation of Robert Zimmerman. It's the idea is that you create yourself. You don't find yourself. You create yourself. And it really conveys that really well. And the music stuff is done really well. It leans hard into the songs. And there's like a dozen scenes of like people watching Bob Dylan sing a song for the first time. And they look on with a mixture of awe and resentment. And that could get old after a while. Mm-hmm. They could have done that 12 more times and they all would have worked for me. Because the songs are that good.
All right. Thank you, Chris. Appreciate it.